Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Noll, and I'd like to welcome you to a special presentation. This is a part of our ongoing series on fascism in the United States as a part of the Progressive Commentary Hour. From Frank Morales, Global Research, Homeland Defense, the Pentagon declares war on America, and it started with the Patriot Act. As you can see, we have a lot to share. But let us be clear of what we're talking about, because unfortunately on programs such as all of them on MSNBC, all of them on Fox, the moment you mention that America has become a fascistic nation, a police state, they'll roll their eyes or say this is merely conspiratorial conjecture. It's not true. It's an extremist point of view. And I will say to the contrary, what I find extreme is for those individuals who know the truth, are smart enough to tell you the truth, but realize that it would be against their own financial or career interest to do so. As a result, we've had this morphing of so-called democratic and liberal principles into a corporate and liberal elite. We've seen this with the Clintons, the Obamas, and vast amounts of individuals going forth to proclaim that all the problems in the United States are the responsibility of the Republicans or conservative philosophy, and that if we only abided by their notions, it would be a truly wonderful environment to live in. On the other hand, we have all of the conservative talk radio and television personalities who act as the official spokespersons, the opinion leaders of the corporatized conservative perspective. But at the end of the day, it need not matter whether it's David Koch or his brothers or George Soros. Politically identified as either liberal or conservative that are causing the problem and manipulating the system and controlling with vast amounts of wealth through foundations, think tanks, and special contract relationships with governmental agencies, virtually everything in our lives. Let us begin by defining fascism. According to Webster's dictionary, quote, a political philosophy, a movement, or a regime that exalts nation and sometimes race above the individual and that stands for a centralized autocratic government headed by a dictatorial leader, severe economic and social regimentation, and forcible suppression of opposition, a tendency towards or actual exercise of strong autocratic or dictatorial control. Fascism would not exist without totalitarianism. It is the handmaiden. Webster's definition, quote, of totalitarianism, centralized control by an autocratic authority. The political concept that the citizen should be totally subject to an absolute state of authority. Now, how is that possible? Well, ask yourself this. When you go into a hospital to get a job, are you allowed to work there if you do not get vaccinated? How many students are forced to take a teen screen test, even without their parents' permission or knowledge, that would require them to submit answers that could then be judged against them? And it has been. When we go into an airport, we have to go through screening. Even when that screening involves groping us in our body's private parts, they can stop and frisk people at will on the street. If you live within 100 miles of any of the border of the United States, not just the Mexican and Canadian border, but even on the East Coast and West Coast, they can seize your computer and not tell you why. They can download all the information off of it and give you no explanation. You have virtually no recourse. They have been listening to virtually all of our communications. Every single word that you have uttered, every single phone call, text message, every fax, every electronic communication, they have recorded. They have been in the process of installing smart meters on homes which can monitor where in the home you are, how many people are there. It's not what they told us about trying to make our energy use in a home more efficient. It's a way of monitoring us. They have also demanded and received permission to be able to take our DNA. They have called all protests against animal cruelty as suspect, and anyone who reports on any form of animal cruelty is now listed as a terrorist suspect. Every single one of the people that involved themselves in Occupy Wall Street were ending up being scanned. They were infiltrated. And even when they were only engaging in their constitutional right of assembly and freedom of speech, it was being used against them. They even had marksmen. They had snipers on the roofs ready to take the people out, knowing full well that none of these people represented any threat to the United States. There were over 6,700 arrests of these individuals. Many were pepper sprayed and beaten. They had the right to give unlimited amounts of money, our money, without any discussion, in secret, through the Federal Reserve to over 20 major corporations, including privately held banks, hedge funds, equity partnerships, and publicly traded corporations like Verizon. In 22,000 transactions, more than $16.2 trillion was given to these individuals at zero interest. They took toxic assets, bad debt, and washed it through their system, in effect, a legal form of money laundering. They allowed major banks that dealt in money laundering of drug and terrorist monies to the tune of more than $300 billion in one bank alone. And yet not one of those people was charged with a crime. Yet if you or I break the simplest law, we will be dealt with harshly. They break the worst laws and no crime at all against them. They lie to us about weapons of mass destruction. And the consequences, both intended and unintended, means that more than 4 million Iraqis were displaced from their homes. An entire nation was permanently contaminated for the rest of time with depleted uranium that's in the soil and water and air. They have now the highest rate of birth defects in the world of any nation, and more than 1 million dead. And yet no one has taken any responsibility for having not misguided intelligence, not the wrong intelligence. They created in the vice president's office their own CIA within the CIA to massage and manipulate the data. These are crimes against humanity. No one is being held accountable. That is fascism. That is totalitarianism. But how would you know? If you're the average person and you're trying to come to grips with, well, are we a fascist country or not? Are we engaged in totalitarian practices or not? Here are some of the indicators. These are the red flags. Powerful and continuing expressions of nationalism, both on the part of the regime itself and the citizens caught up in its frenzy. Pride in the military and demands for unity are common themes in expressing this nationalism. As an example, we're now told that we should trust that the intelligence that we have been given vis-a-vis the Mossad, which has repeatedly manipulated intelligence for its own benefit and that of Israel, is right, but there's so much we cannot be told. We're told because it's secret. And yet this is the same government that has repeatedly lied. In fact, all major political and military incursions in other countries we have found historically were lies. We were told that the communists were overtaking South and Central America and therefore required our assistance in training the military in each of those countries to suppress the communists. Reality, we suppressed land movements, unions, people who wanted a living wage, people wanted environmental protection, people wanted some form of a reasonable work schedule, people were against child labor. And that was the truth in every country. And yet, because of corporate control over those issues, working major corporations hand in glove with our State Department, White House, we created coups. We created imbalances. We undermined every single democratically elected official in Central and South America over the past 50 years. Yet we supported, without question, major dictators. The major family in Nicaragua that ran the National Guard, that owned all the car dealers, major car dealerships, that was the wealthiest family down there, the Somoza family. And yet we turned a blind eye to that. Pinochet, we turned a blind eye. We collaborated. We got into the Vietnam War under lies that were later found to be lies. President of the United States lied, Lyndon Johnson, and Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara lied. They were never held accountable. We lied about the first Iraq War in 90. It wasn't about helping Kuwait. It was about making sure that we had the power in that area of the world that we wanted for our allies and ourselves and the resources. And the second Iraq War in 2003. We knew in advance there were no weapons of mass destructions. The UN inspector said there were no weapons of mass destructions. And now we want to go into Libya. And we did the same thing with massive bombing. And what was the outcome of Libya? Did we make it a better place, a more democratic place? No. As I predicted on this program, it is massively chaotic with dozens of tribes all fighting each other. The quality of life destroyed. The resources exploited, all so that American and British corporations, French corporations, can have the right to exploit its oil and water. And look at all the religious fundamentalists that we armed, the jihadists, the Al-Qaeda. That's what's happening also with our efforts in Syria. And look at how the media demands that we support a retaliation. And what exactly is supposed to be the consequence of this retaliation? And what gives us the right to retaliate? Who says that we are the ones that should decide what should happen in a country? We have no absolute proof of which group has caused the chemical and biological weapons attack against these innocent civilians. And yet we're willing to go immediately, even before the inspectors had finished their detailed report against the Syrian regime. How much sense does it make knowing that weapons inspectors were coming the very week that an attack occurred? Knowing that you'd be accused of it, it makes no sense. Makes a lot of sense if you're the opposition. And the opposition is funded and controlled through Saudi Arabia. And it's radicalized Wahhabi religious Sunni zealots. Funding of Al-Qaeda, supporting Al-Qaeda, because that's who would win if any strikes against Assad in Syria were devastating, then the hand would go towards Al-Qaeda, and we would have another Libya, and we would have nothing but sectarian slaughter. So what are we doing? We're telling the Syrians, because someone in your country killed Syrians, we're going to teach you all a lesson by killing more Syrians. How in the world does that make any sense? It does not. But look again towards fascism for the answer. Characteristics of modern fascism based on Lawrence Britt, a historian and former corporate executive. First, the powerful and continuing expressions of nationalism, both on the part of the regime itself and the citizens caught up in its frenzy, who are the ultimate frenzied fascist leaders. Well, Sean Hannity and Bill O'Reilly and Ann Coulter. No discussion, no scholarship, no lessons of history, no irony at how often they've been wrong. But those are the people leading it. An excess pride in the military and demands for unity are common themes in expressing this nationalism. So what happens when you don't agree? You're suddenly the enemy. Also, you have opposition against immigration. You increase your association with U.S. with the white race. Those in power generally are white and wealthy. You have a disdain for the importance of human rights, and you view human rights as of little value and a hindrance to realizing the objectives of the ruling elite. And through clever use of the propaganda machine, the population is brought to accept human rights abuses by marginalizing, even demonizing, those being targeted. When abuse is egregious, use secrecy, denial, and disinformation. You will not be challenged by anyone at ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN. It won't happen. It hasn't happened. They control the New York Times, the Washington Post. They control all the major media in the United States. Guantanamo and black site prisons offered torture, abuse, and waterboarding. They're still open. The National Defense Authorization Law and other executive orders give the president dictatorial power. They're not challenged. The war on terror has made people more lenient to give up their rights. It's stupid. Also, identification of enemies and/or scapegoats as a unifying cause. Relentless use of propaganda and disinformation. Often fascist regimes incite spontaneous acts against the target scapegoats, usually communists, socialists, liberals, Jews, ethnic and racial minorities, traditional national enemies, members of other religions, secularists, homosexuals, are all then considered no better than terrorists. The ultimate scapegoat today, it's the Muslims, and yet we're supporting Al-Qaeda. Unlike Hitler and Mussolini, today's fascism uses the left-right dialectic to maintain control over a divided populace. Supremacy of the military and the military intelligence complex and the industrial infrastructure that supports it. A disproportionate share of national resources was allocated to the military. Do you realize how much of every dollar you give in taxes goes to the military industrial complex? A minimum of 53%. In fact, the U.S. spends more on defense than all the other nations of the world combined. And to what extent? Who out there is actually going to attack us? No one. Also, there's rampant sexism. Beyond the simple fact that the political elite and the national culture are male-dominated, fascist regimes inevitably view women as second-class citizens. They anti-abortion and homophobic reliant. Give you an example. In the 25 years that hundreds of thousands of women have been sexually abused in the military, when was the last time anyone of a higher rank that was aware of this was ever held accountable? How about never? When you have people like Larry Summers, when you have a misogynist, sexist person that is purely based upon corporate greed being considered and probably will receive the position of head of the Federal Reserve, when you look at his long sordid tenure, that's the best we can do. That's perfect in a fascist world. You have a controlled mass media. Under some fascist regime, the mass media is under strict, direct control and can be relied upon never to stray from the party line. Methods include the control of licensing and access to resources and economic pressure and appeals to patriotism and implied threats. The leaders of the mass media are often politically compatible with the power elite, either on the left or right. Fox News and the rest of the major networks, fascist. In 1983, 50 corporations ran the U.S. media. Today, 6. The White House is about to launch its own TV news station. Now there's a crackdown on journalists, Michael Hastings, Assange, Glenn Greenwald. There's an obsession with national security. National security is under direct control of the ruling elite. Its actions are justifiable under the rubric of protecting national security. And questioning its activities was portrayed as unpatriotic, even treasonous. Also, understand that we are not interested as a nation in what Snowden or Bradley Manning exposed, but the fact they did it. Hence, they can be easily pillared for showing us the truth. We attack the messenger. The message becomes irrelevant. Obama now heads a whole group of people capable of being the number one assassination team in the world. Seizure of private property under umbrella national security, widespread confiscation of computers, mobile phones and cameras, your home, your car, all can be confiscated without any writ, any warrant, any anything today. And the religious and ruling elite are tied together. Most fascists must have the predominant religion in the country and choose to portray themselves as militant defenders of that religion. And they are zealots. Also, the Republican Democratic candidates will go after the Christian vote, and the Christians then align themselves with the ideology. Power of corporations is protected. Although the personal life of ordinary citizens is under strict control, the ability of large corporations to operate in relative freedom is not compromised. The Citizens United ruling was the final step towards complete fascism in the United States by the Supreme Court. You have TARP. You have the 2011 corporate tax rate reached a 10-year low. You have to continue deregulation. You have protection to private security corporations contracting for government spying. You have protection of big agri, big pharma, big insurance, big medicine. You have the suppression of labor and its influences. And since organized labor was in the past seen as the one power center that could challenge political power and its corporate allies, it is essential to crush labor, and they're doing exactly that. Unions are being dismantled across the country. Scott Walker, the Koch brothers, Rahm Emanuel in Chicago. And disdain and suppression of intellectuals in the arts. Intellectuals and the inherent freedom of ideas are anathema to fascist regimes and subversive to national security and patriotic ideals. Universities are very tightly controlled, and where at one time in the United States, universities were the breeding ground for some of the greatest intellectual and diverse minds, today, very few are coming out. Controlled academics are coming out. They know where the funds are. They know where the grants are. They know that if they want to have a secure financial future and be accepted into that sacred ring, they must compromise everything. And they do. The Clinton, Bush, Obama administrations, fascistic as you can get, ignored independent academic intellectual feedback on every critical challenge, economic issues, foreign policy issues, fracking, genetically modified organisms, clean coal. What an oxymoron. Climate change, they were all in denial of. Not a single one of those people have done a single thing in any administration to effectively challenge climate change. They've all contributed to it. But they can talk as if they're interested. The obsession with crime and punishment. Most fascistic regimes maintain draconian systems of criminal justice with huge prison populations. Police are often glorified and have almost unchecked power, leading to rampant abuse. And hence, the completely absurd, stupid, vile, vulgar war on drugs. It should not exist. The privatization of prisons would only come with a fascistic regime. The stop and frisk in New York, fascism at its finest. Now, maybe I missed something, but I didn't see New York City's, call them finest, down on Wall Street, stopping 500,000 people 1 year from getting into their limos or going to their exclusive clubs and holding them accountable for what was in their pockets. But I did see 500,000 that were stopped and frisked who were black and Puerto Rican and then told to empty their pockets. And if they had even a small amount of marijuana in the pocket, the moment it became in public view, they were arrested and sent off to jail for years. There are now more people in jail in the United States than during Stalin's gulag reign. It is a felony to protest near anyone with Secret Service protection. The trouble is, you don't know who has Secret Service protection, and they will arrest you, slam you, taser you, beat you, imprison you if you dare challenge them. Rampant cronyism and corruption, that is simply the standard everywhere in America today. With the national security apparatus under control, the media, corruption is largely unconstrained and not well understood by the general population. Everything on Wall Street is corrupt. The entire banking system, all the foreclosures were corrupt. No sentencing of repeat offenses in big pharma, big insurance. British Petroleum and Katrina catastrophe, who went to jail? No one. Was there malice aforethought? Yes. Hydrofracking corruption? It's allowed. Fraudulent elections. When actual elections with candidates are held, they're usually perverted by the power elite to get the desired results. You buy your candidate, you select them, you control them, and you put them in power. So those are some of the red herrings that determine that something is fascistic. Now, according to Global Research and Anthony Gucciardi, in what should be front page news blasted nationwide as a breaking news alert, the Department of Homeland Security has openly established extensive, for want of a better concept, constitution-free zones in which your Fourth Amendment does not exist. Now, what do I mean? It's not conspiracy and it's not fraud. The Department of Homeland Security has literally created an imaginary border within the United States that engulfs 100 miles from every single end of the nation. Within this fabricated border, the Department of Homeland Security can search your electronic belongings for no reason. We're talking about no suspicion, no reasonable cause, nothing. No reason whatsoever is required under their own regulations. The Department of Homeland Security is now above the Constitution under their own rules, and even Wired magazine authors were amazed at the level of pure tyranny going on here. The so-called border even includes where the U.S. land meets oceans. What's that mean? It means that over 197 million American citizens live within a 100-mile border zone that includes all the major cities. What are those cities where you really could be taken and all your electronic data without any notice at all? Well, from Miami and Fort Lauderdale and Palm Beach, Orlando, Jacksonville, Tampa, St. Petersburg, you could have Corpus Christi, Houston, San Antonio, El Paso, Los Angeles, Bakersfield, Riverside, San Francisco, Stockton, Sacramento, Redding, Portland, Tacoma, Seattle, Spokane. You could have Bangor, Maine, Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Virginia Beach, Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Pittsburgh. That is the reality. And then we have the case of the President of the United States quietly signing his name to an executive order, allowing the White House to control all private communications in the country in the name of national security. It was called the Assignment of National Security and Emergency Preparedness Communications Function. It's 2,205 words. And, quote, in explaining the order, the Electronic Privacy Information Center writes that the President has authorized the Department of Homeland Security the authority to seize private facilities when necessary, effectively shutting down or limiting civilian communications. Well, then why don't we have a media that has the courage to stand up and discuss this? It's possible. But according to Norman Solomon, Obama's escalating war on freedom is a war against the press. The part of the First Amendment that prohibits abridging the freedom of the press is now up against the wall as the Obama administration continues to assault the kind of journalism that can expose government secrets. The administration got what it wanted, an ice-cold, chilling effect from the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which ruled on the case of the New York Times reporter James Rison. The court, quote, delivered a blow to investigative journalism in America by ruling that reporters have no First Amendment protection that would safeguard the confidentiality of their sources in the event of a criminal trial, end quote. The executive branch fought for that ruling and is now celebrating, quote, we agree with the decision, end quote, said a Justice Department spokesman. Quote, we are examining the next steps in the prosecution of this case. The Rison case and potentially many others are now under the ominous shadow of the appeals court pronouncement. There is no First Amendment testimonial privilege, absolutely none, that protects a reporter from being compelled to testify in criminal proceedings. At the Freedom of the Press Foundation, co-founder Trevor Tim calls the court ruling, quote, the most significant reporter's privilege decision in decades, eviscerated that privilege. He's not exaggerating. Press freedom is at stake. Journalists who can be compelled to violate the confidentiality of their sources or otherwise go to prison are reduced to doing little more than providing stenographic service to pass along the official story. That's what the White House wants. So, as an award-winning investigative journalist who has broken over 300 stories, out of 600 stories, I've reported over 28 cover stories on major issues over a 25-year period for one magazine alone. 95% of the people that provided me information would not have done so had I not given them my absolute word that they would have remained anonymous and not be the source of retaliation. Today, the law would not allow me to do that. Who then is going to come forward and tell you the truth if you cannot protect them? War on whistleblowers is now in full speed. According to Marcy Wheeler, when Thomas Drake, then an official at the National Security Agency, realized that the agency's decision to shut down an internal data analysis program and instead outsource the project to a private contractor provided the government with less effective analysis at much higher cost, he tried to do something about it. Drake's decision to join three other whistleblowers in asking the agency inspector general to investigate ultimately made him the target of a leak investigation that tore his life apart. The Inspector General of the Department of Defense, of which the National Security Agency is a part, confirmed the whistleblower's accusations of waste, fraud, and security risk. That's good, right? No. Earlier this year, former National Security Director Michael Hayden even conceded that Trailblazer, the program for which the National Security Agency paid over $1 billion to the Science Applications International Corporation, had failed. The agency, after killing its own program, called the Thin Thread, quote, outsource how we gather other people's communication, he said in response to a question when investigative journalist Tim Shurik, quote, and that was a bridge too far for industry. We tried a moonshot and it failed. Nevertheless, Drake's efforts to expose that waste and abuse would ultimately lead to his being charged under the 1917 Espionage Act, a law intended for the prosecution of spies, not whistleblowers. Drake, a subject of a documentary, The War on Whistleblowers, Free Press and the National Security State, could have been put away for the rest of his life. He could have been tortured, or he could have been killed. Quote, speaking truth to power is now a criminal act, Drake told filmmaker Robert Greenwald. The investigation that would ensnare Drake began in 2006 under the Bush administration, but he wasn't charged until 2010. When the Obama administration accused him of providing information to Baltimore Sun reporter Gorman, who wrote a series of articles on the National Security Agency and its inefficiencies, and sourced as many as 18 people, including Drake, who contends that he did not provide any classified information to her, and that was shown. Rather than charging him with leaking classified information, the government charged him with retaining classified information. Over the course of the investigation, however, the government admitted that some of the documents in question had subsequently either been declassified or were never classified to begin with. In effect, they had no case against him. Didn't stop him from destroying his life. And that's what they do. And they've done it with all the whistleblowers. They're always on a fishing expedition. And they can come with a SWAT team. They can do anything they want. So then that gets us to the point of trying to understand, how do we end up in this incredible global police state? Well, Tom Englehart shares 5 points, and I think they're of value, so I'll quote them. The urge to be global, quote, corporately speaking, globalization has been ballyhooed since at least the 1990s, but in government terms, only in the 21st century has that globalizing urge fully infected the working of the American state itself. It's become common since 9/11 to speak of a national security state. But if ongoing revelations about the National Security Agency's surveillance practices has revealed anything, it's that the term is already grossly outdated. Based upon what we now know, we should be talking about an American global security state. Yeah. And by the way, why aren't all the people who care about the Constitution complaining, protesting, about the abrogation of the First and Fourth Amendments of the Constitution? And sometimes naming practices are revealing in themselves, and the National Security Agency's key data mining tool capable of gathering 96 billion pieces of intelligence from computer networks worldwide instantly has been named Boundless Informant. So if you want a sense of where the U.S. intelligence community imagines itself going, you couldn't ask for a better hint than the word boundless. It seems that our spies, conceptually speaking, have no limit on this planet. And then as an aside, imagine all the people of every major government, including all of our allies, now finding out through the leaks of Snowden and Glenn Greenwald and The Guardian that every single one of their emails, private messages, the president of Mexico before he became president, we found out today that all of his emails were read. Who gave them the right? These are sovereign countries. These are individuals who have protection as sovereign entities. And we assume that we can go in and just take everyone's phone calls, everyone's messages. These people are not engaged in tyranny against the United States. These people are not terrorists. No one in England and France and Germany and Israel intends to attack America. These are not supporters of Al-Qaeda. And yet, we believe that we have the right to look at every single piece of communication in the world, and no one has a right not to reveal themselves. The 20th century was the century of totalitarianisms. We don't yet have a name, a term, for the surveillance structure Washington is building in this country, in this century. But there can be no question that whatever the present constraints on the system, total has something to do with it, and that we are being ushered into a new world. Despite the recent leaks, we still undoubtedly have a very limited picture of just what the present American surveillance world really looks like and what it plans for our future. In the classic totalitarian regimes of the previous century, a secret police, a surveillance force, attempted via every imaginable method, including informers, wiretappers, torture techniques, imprisonment, and so on, to take control of a national environment, to turn every citizen's life into the equivalent of an open book, or more accurately, a closed secret file lodged somewhere in that police system. None of the 20th century totalitarian regimes, however, ever imagined doing what these people today are doing. Washington has taken it to a different level. The urge to possess you, or everything you can know, is what they're up to. They want to know every possession that you have and everyone else in the world. They want to know what you're thinking, what you're doing. They want to know what books you're reading. Hence, they have already taken every single thing that you've done, every movie you've rented on Netflix, every book you've taken out of a library, your shopping habits, what you eat, where you eat, how often you eat, what you spend on a meal, what movies you go to. They want everything. Take something seemingly unrelated, the recent Supreme Court decision that allows the police to take a DNA swab from an arrestee. Theoretically, this is being done for identification purposes, but in fact, it's already been put into other uses entirely. If you stop and think about it, this development in turn represents a remarkable new level of state intrusion on private life, on your life. It means that for the first time in a short, a widened set of circumstances, the state increasingly has access, not just as the National Security Agency surveillance, to your internet codes and modes of communication, but to your most basic code of all, your DNA. As Justice Anton Scalia put it in his dissent in this case, make no mistake about it, quote, as an entirely predictable consequence of today's decision, your DNA can be taken and entered into a national DNA database if you're ever arrested, rightly or wrongly, and for whatever reason. Well, that is something we should consider. If your DNA becomes the possession of a state and then you are a transparent human being at your most basic level. At every level, however, the pattern, the tread, is that you are a part of them. Increasingly, access to you, your codes, your communications, your purchases, your credit card transactions, your location, your travels, what your sexual preferences are, your taste, your likes, your dislikes, all that they have collected. How does that help us? How does that make us safer? They want everything. At least that way they can run you through a system of massive computers and put you into compartments. Your acts, your life patterns, your rights, your codes, every protest you've engaged in, they know it all. And yet at the same time that they want us to be completely transparent, they're becoming completely opaque. With this goes another contradiction. They are becoming ever less accessible, even more impenetrable, ever less knowable to you. None of their codes or secrets are to be accessed by you on pain of imprisonment or death. Everything in the government, which was once thought to be your government, is increasingly disappearing into a professional universe of secrecy. Just last year, they classified 92 million documents. Why? Because they could. If they had their way, every single document, every single communication, every single everything would be 100% secret, and you are viewed as the enemy. In the process, they are finding new ways of imposing silence on you, even when it comes to yourself. In 2001, for instance, it became possible for the FBI to present you with a national security letter, which forces you to turn over information to them, but far more strikingly gags you from even mentioning publicly that you got such a letter. You can't tell anyone. You can't tell your own lawyer. You can't tell a member of your family. Those who have received letters, 15,000 of them in just last year, are legally enjoined from discussing or even acknowledging what's happening to them. Their lives, that is, are no longer theirs to discuss. They can be imprisoned, tortured, beaten, or anything the FBI wants to do. And we know what kind of people are in the FBI. This is truly Orwellian. And when did you ever hear this discussed on MSNBC? President Obama offered this reassurance in the wake of the Snowden leaks that the National Security Agency is operating under the supervision of all three branches. No, it is not. All the branches, especially in their oversight roles, have failed miserably. Why? Because they're also subject to the same provisions. They cannot tell anyone, even if they're on a committee and know that illegalities are being committed, because they will then be punished. As a result, we have people like James Clapper, Director of National Intelligence, getting up and lying under oath, yet nothing will happen to him. Given the secret world's control over Congress, representatives who are horrified, because what more sordid group of dysfunctional sociopaths do you have than our Congress? The lowest of the low. Little wonder everything in their background is now known. Similarly, the judiciary, the third branch of government, and other body of oversight has in the 21st century been fully welcomed into the global security state's atmosphere of total secrecy. So when the surveillance crews go to the judiciary for permission to listen in on the world, they go to a secret court, a foreign intelligence FISA court, surveillance court, locked within that secret world. It, in turn, notoriously rubber stamps whatever it is told to do. How do we know? Well, here's what we do know. 6,556 electronic surveillance requests submitted to the court in Obama's first term in office. Only one was denied. In addition, unlike any other court in America, we the people, the transparent and ignorant public, can know nothing about it. What, though, is the point of oversight if you cannot know whether or not it is accurate? And all this is expanding at a tremendous level. So where does that bring us? That brings us to this point, that all this would not be happening if it weren't for the corporation. The word corporation is derived from the Latin corporare, meaning to physically embody. In his History of the Corporation, Bruce Brown, according to Professor Brian Minch, notes how in the first 1,000 years after the fall of the Roman Empire, the world's most powerful corporations were all trying to embody the Christian God. In 1534, St. Thomas More spoke of Jesus Christ as the ultimate corporation. He, meaning Jesus, doth incorporate all Christian folk and has his own body together in one corporationum. Needless to say, in the 21st century, corporations are creations of civilization that make no pretense of embodying the Christian God. In fact, today, corporations come much closer to embodying Mary Shelley's Frankenstein than Jesus Christ. Ironically, created by and managed by humans, corporations have become almost robotic monsters, perpetrating, even feeding off human misery, threatening every aspect of human life, the air we breathe, the water we drink, the food we eat, and even the future of mankind himself. What have these corporate Frankenstein monsters done to us lately? Well, let's just listen to what we broadcast every day on this show. At least 1,126 people have died in a collapsed garment factory in Bangladesh, the deadliest such accident in world history. The largest American clothing corporations, Gap, Walmart, and Target, who are the end users of these death trap factories, did any of them come out and say this was wrong? We have been profiting at someone else's pain and misery and suffering at 14 cents an hour? No, they did not. We had 15 people who were killed over 200 injured in West Texas from an explosion at a fertilizer plant. Why? Because of greed. Rummaging over the current historical larger scale threats to entire societies, countries, and mankind in general, we see a grotesque recurrent theme. Corporations willing to kill, maim, and destroy even their own creators in the name of profit. The science on the broad consequences of cigarette smoking was well established in Nazi Germany by the early 1940s. Nonetheless, tobacco corporations successfully fought any substantive regulation for the next 30 years, while tens of millions of people died early deaths in the name of tobacco profits. Recall the testimony in 1994 from the CEOs of the seven largest tobacco corporations before Congress, unanimously declaring that nicotine is not addictive, knowing full well that killing people was part of making them rich. Were any of them held accountable after the whistleblower came out and showed they had lied? Not a one of them. Marketing cigarette addiction to children was an integral part of the strategy. But the tobacco industry was no worse than the lead industry. For the first 70 years of the 20th century, awareness of lead's serious health consequences, including madness and death, dates back to the Romans, the first to use it extensively. Symptoms of plumbism or lead poisoning were already apparent as early as the first century. Mental incompetence from lead exposure came to be synonymous with the Roman elite, manifesting in the shocking imbecilic emperors Caligula, Nero, and Commodus. For over 60 years, the Ethyl Corporation, General Motors, Standard Oil, DuPont, and the American Petroleum Institute obscured, obstructed, and lied about the mounting evidence of a public health catastrophe from the lead, aggressively marketed worldwide and fighting every attempt to regulate it or curtail its use. Ethyl Corporation even increased its overseas business 1,000% between 64 and 81, while its product came under growing harsh scrutiny in the United States. C.M. Shai of the University of North Carolina School of Public Health, in a paper published by the World Health Statistics Quarterly, declared leaded gasoline, quote, is the mistake of the 20th century. A report commissioned by the United Nations calculated the yearly global cost of lead in gasoline had reached 1.1 million deaths, 322 million lost IQ points, 60 million crimes committed, and an economic loss of 4% of global gross domestic product, or $2.4 trillion. Lead didn't even benefit engine performance. Lead, like other heavy metals, does not degrade, is non-combustible, and is never destroyed. The world was permanently blanketed with this deadly metal purely for corporate profit. In 1898, asbestos was declared in Great Britain to be an extremely hazardous dust. By the 1920s, lawsuits began to be filed against asbestos industry. The John Mansfield Corporation then successfully lobbied for national legislation shunting asbestos workers' claims to workers' compensation panels and away from juries, with the industry effectively shielding themselves from costly plaintiff lawsuits, they proceeded to fund medical studies. They funded them. They got the results they wanted. You always will when you pay for the research. And when those published results were falsified, exonerating asbestos as a cause of cancer, no one said boo. When independent studies revealed widespread disease from asbestos, internal corporate memos callously mocked their workers, stating, quote, if you have enjoyed a good life for working with asbestos products, why not die from it? Publicly, asbestos companies claimed there was no evidence people could become sick and die from asbestos exposures. Internally, however, asbestos executives admitted that the disease process begins as soon as asbestos is inhaled. It is progressive and irreversible and is verily closely advanced by the time it is diagnosed. Eventually, Johns Manfield filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. David Auster, the attorney in charge of the Mansfield Trust, said the documents show the corporations and executives knew the dangers of asbestos back in the 1930s, but hid it. Enter Monsanto. Forbes magazine gave Monsanto its Company of the Year award. Yeah, great. And what has it given us? It gave us genetic engineered seeds. It gave us Agent Orange. It gave us so many things that degrade life. In pursuing this business model, Monsanto has managed to do more damage to the world's food supply, in many people's opinion, and public health, than any other single entity. And yet, it has full access to the White House, the halls of Congress. Its own employees end up with major positions, policymaking positions in government. Exactly none of the supposed benefits of genetic modified crops. Increased yields, more food production, controlled pests and weeds, reduction of chemical use in agriculture, or drought-tolerant seeds have actually materialized. It's all been a lie. And yet studies show tumors in rats after 3 months. Virtually every branch of the U.S. government, including the Supreme Court and the World Bank, has acted as Monsanto's handmaiden, oftentimes using taxpayer money to do so. Monsanto's ruthless business practices, high-speed seed prices, and vicious legal attacks have played a key role in the disappearance of small and medium-sized farms, bankrupting small farmers and driving rural agriculture further towards huge monocultures and complete control by a handful of agribusinesses and food processing corporations. There is a growing epidemic among small farmers in many countries, especially India, of suicides. Over 250,000 have committed suicide. Yet you won't see a word about this in American media. And then look at all the major drugs that now, if there's an adverse effect, if it kills you, if they had malice of forethought in manufacturing and knew in advance that would kill you, you cannot sue them. So says the Supreme Court. All vaccines exempt from litigation to the corporation. It's just a pure profit incentive. So then you get a little better understanding of how coal, nuclear, gas, hydrofracking, banking systems, big agra, insurance industries, the medical industrial complex, the military industrial complex, the spying complex work together in controlling the political process with the American Exchange Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, at the state level, to influence over 20,000 pieces of legislation in all 50 states to control the outcome. And at the federal level, with tens of thousands of lobbyists and consultants, they control everything. They can control the present. They control every single step. And that is how we ended up with fascism. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening.